Ngadala ngarari, ngadala ngarari, ngadala bayangu, ngadala bayangu, danadi nyungo yari, danadi nyungo yari, nyuari nyuari, wakamuru wakamuru, wakamuru wakamuru, nyuari nyuari. Yunu jari, yunu jari, kijangara, kanyara, nyanjul jari, bayangu, nyungu jari.
That was Hazel Kulyu-Walga singing a song in Bayungu. The title of the song translates into English as My Country.
Hi, I'm James McIlvenny, and you're listening to the History and Philosophy of the Language Sciences podcast, online at hifilangsci.net. There you can find links and references to all the literature we discuss. Today we're joined by Gilad Zuckerman, who's Professor of Linguistics at the University of Adelaide in South Australia. Among other things, Gilad is an expert on language revival and reclamation, a field that he calls revivalistics. In 2020, he published a monograph treating this topic with Oxford University Press under the title Revivalistics: From the Genesis of Israeli to Language Reclamation in Australia and Beyond. So Gilad, what is revivalistics? Or rather, what does it mean to revive a language?
Revivalistics is a new comparative global transdisciplinary field of inquiry surrounding language reclamation, revitalization, and reinvigoration from any angle possible. For example, mental health, law, anthropology, sociology, politics, colonization studies. What is language revival? You see, language revival is on a spectrum. The most extreme case of language revival is what I call reclamation. Reclamation is when you have no native speakers of the language you're trying to revive. This is in the case of a sleeping beauty like Hebrew. Hebrew was a sleeping beauty, meaning no native speakers, since 135 AD for 1,750 years. Or a dreaming beauty. So a dreaming beauty alluding to Jukurpa, the dream time or the dreaming, such as the Bangla Aboriginal language of Eyre Peninsula. You had no native speakers of Bangla for, say, 50 years, 60 years since the 1960s. And reclamation is a severe case because you have nobody to listen to who is a native speaker. Now, on this spectrum in the middle, you have what I call revitalization. So revitalization is of a language that is severely endangered, but it still has some elders speaking it. For example, Adnya Matna. Adnya means rock and Matna means people. So Adnya Matna, rock people. These are the Aboriginal people of the Flinders Ranges, not that far from Adelaide. And I have a friend called Robert Wilton. He's in his 80s, and he is a native speaker of Adnya Matna. In the case of Adnya Matna, the percentage of native speakers among children is almost zero. And of course, in order to determine whether a language is endangered, I don't care about numbers. I only care about percentage of children within the tribe speaking the language. So for example, Pijanjara is alive and kicking even though it is only spoken by 3,500 people, but say almost 100% of kids speak it. Whereas you might have some languages in Africa with a million speakers, but they're severely endangered because the percentage of children speaking the language is very low.
So is your understanding of a native speaker someone who learns language in this critical period as it's understood by generative linguists?
And in fact, I would say he or she does not learn, but rather acquires automatically. So say, I'm a native speaker of Israeli, you're a native speaker of Australian English, we both speak many other languages, but we learned them. thereafter. Now, in the kind of other side from reclamation, so we said reclamation, we have revitalization, and then you have reinvigoration. Reinvigoration is when you have a relatively high percentage of kids speaking the language, but still not 100%. The language is endangered. Welsh, maybe Irish, still very endangered, but you know, it's not as bad as Adnyamatna, definitely not as Bangala. So in the case of revitalization, which is kind of in the middle, and reinvigoration, we can, for example, use a technique called master-apprentice, because we have a master, we have somebody who speaks the language natively. This is in diametric opposition to the case of reclamation, where we have no masters whatsoever. Now, what is the master-apprentice technique? You take a master, usually an old person who is a native speaker of the language, who, as you said, had acquired the language automatically, say, between the age of zero and puberty. And you ask this master to adopt, if you want, an apprentice. An apprentice is a young person, can be a child, can be a teenager, who do not speak the language, but they would help the master with daily tasks, shopping, etc. And the master would speak to them only in language. So the idea in the case of revitalization and reinvigoration is to reintroduce the language to youngsters who will then become native speakers, or at least speakers. In the case of reclamation, of course, we cannot use the master-apprentice technique, but we can use other techniques. Like, I'm teaching Bangala, well, I've taught maybe hundreds of workshops in the bush to various communities of Bangala people. And we neologize together. So for example, a word for computer, Gaga Bibi Waribirga, so Gaga is head, Bibi is egg, so Gaga Bibi is brain, it's the egg inside the head, and Waribirga is lightning, so it's kind of a lightning or electric brain. So lightning or electric brain, a little bit like Chinese. Yeah, now the Maori, Te Reo Maori, the language Maori, Rorohiko, did the same thing. You might ask yourself, let's forget about Chinese, let's forget about Maori or Ghana. I mean, you ask Bangla people, okay, how would you like to say computer? And it might well be the case that they will come up with brain and lightning, because I guess there are many other possibilities, but it's a good one. So in the case of Rorohiko in Maori, I would have to research whether there was somebody who was involved in their neologization, who had been exposed to Chinese. Now, if we talk about Bangala, Clamor Wilhelm Schumann, the German Lutheran missionary, who arrived in Australia in 1838, he knew five languages, which, of course, as a revivalist, I must be fluent in, because if I'm not, then I cannot analyze his dictionary properly. And here you have a historical linguistic angle of revivalistics. He knew German, of course. It was his Mameloschen, or Muttersprache, the mother language, native language. He knew Latin. He knew Greek. He knew Hebrew. And he knew English. These five languages are reflected within his 1844 dictionary of the Bangla language. For example, as a German, he did not have the R sound as phonemic, in the sense that in German you either say Hamburg or Hamburg. It's not the case that if you say R and then R, it means something different. But in Bangla, R and R are phonemic. So, of course, he might have well failed to notice the difference between R and R. Intriguingly, there is a language near Adelaide called Ngarindjeri. In Ngarindjeri, which is, for example, in Victor Harbour, Port Elliot, Murray Bridge, you did have two phonemes. One is R and one is R. But because of emblematicity, what happens today, and I know some Ngarindjeri people, they forgot about their R phoneme and they pronounce everything with R in order to other Ngarindjeri from the English, and therefore they say Ngarindjeri with a R, R, which is funny because when I say Ngarindjeri, which is the original pronunciation, they would correct me and say, oh, no, it's Ngarindjeri, you know, there is no R, it's R. So this is kind of emblematicity, which is a phenomenon that revivalistics would analyze and look at, you know, what is language revival? Are you trying to reclaim the language as it used to be? Of course you might, but you will never get there. We will not be able to reclaim a language as it used to be. It's okay. Impossible.
So it's not the same thing. And the sources that you're using for language reclamation, so you mentioned an 1844 dictionary, but is that it? Like, are there texts? Because I'm sure that there would be all sorts of aspects of a language that Schumann would have simply not recorded. So how do you fill in all these gaps if your only source is this 1844 dictionary written by a German who wasn't even a native speaker himself?
It's a wonderful question, and let me surprise you. There was a language called Nau. Nau, I write it N-H-A-W-O-O, Nau, because the first N is with your tongue outside, so it's kind of interdental, Nau. But you might find it also as N-A-U-O. Nau only has three lexical items remaining, as far as I know. So the first one is Gardu. Gardu means Aboriginal person. The second one is Yanmura. Yanmura in Nau means white fellow. And the third one is Maldabi. Maldabi, Maldabi. Maldabi means devil. Now, you'll be shocked, but recently they published a dictionary with hundreds of words. Now, how did they do it? They replicated words from Bangla, which is a related language, from Wirangu, a related language. They kind of reconstructed some of the grammatical aspects, looking at Bangla, etc. So even with three words, they're now trying to reclaim their sleeping or their dreaming beauty. A fortiori, in the case of Bangla, where I actually managed to extract 3,500 words from Klamor Wilhelm Schumann's dictionary. Now, let me just give you some details about the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, you had 8,000 distinct words, types.
So this is the Hebrew Old Testament, you mean?
Yes, yeah. The Hebrew Bible. Out of which 2,000 were hapax legomena, appearing only once, which practically means that we are kind of on shaky grounds when it comes to the meaning of a word appearing only once. So, simplistically speaking, the Hebrew Bible is 6,000 words. Now, Bangla, 3,500 words. In order to read a newspaper in Mandarin or modern standard Chinese, you need something like 3,700 words. So we are at the level of a language being alive and kicking. Of course, with 3,500 words, you can make up many more words, you know, just like combinations, etc. And this is with no borrowings in the sense of phonetic adaptation of English words, like, say, in some, as you know, in some Aboriginal languages, horse would be uji, because there is no H, there is no S, so horse would be pronounced as uji, or, say, swamp would be pronounced as Toowoomba, or Toowoomba, as in the town near Brisbane, you know, swamp, Toowoomba. So you can also do that, but without that, we already have 3,500 words. Now, Klamor Wilhelm Schumann also wrote a grammar. His grammar is not, say, kind of a Chomskyan modern grammar, but we actually manage to extract a very big grammar out of it. So I would argue that I have all the material needed for a reclamation in the case of Bangla. Of course, I'm not talking about, you know, intonation in the prosody, in the prosody sense of, you know, of course we're not talking about that. We do not have videos, you know, for example, gestures are extremely important.
So I guess there is a much deeper question about what even is a language. So, I mean, you've been talking mostly about structural features, so like words in particular that you might have in a dictionary, grammar, and then you extended that to prosody and other features of phonology. But what about the deep cultural aspects of a language? So what the words actually mean and the broader cultural context in which they're embedded. So, I mean, the descendants of Ashkenazi Jews living in Israel today would be culturally quite different from people at the court of King David. And in the same way, there's perhaps a big difference in culture that's within certain parts of Aboriginal Australia from before the British invasion, if I can put it that way, to the present day. So what exactly is it that you're reclaiming or reviving in this broader cultural context?
That's a very perspicacious point, because even if we want to go back to the original Weltanschauung, which is very beautifully reflected in language, there have been so many changes post-colonization in the case of Australia that might bar us from doing it. So, for example, in the case of Bangla, if I speak with you and I want to say we, of course I need to use the dual. We have a dual in Bangla as opposed to English. In English, we don't care if we, it's two people or three people. It's still W-E, we. In Bangla, if you are my brother's son and I want to say we two, I would say Narini. If you are my sister's son and I want to say we two, I cannot say Narini. I have to say Nadlaga. Languages differ not in what they can say, but as we know, in what they must say. You must say in old Bangla, Nadlaga, if you are my sister's son, and we must say Narini if you're my brother's son. So it's kind of a matrilineal as opposed to patrilineal dual. Now, in English, not only do you not have a dual, nobody could care less if you're related to each other through the sister or through the brother. Now, why is it important? Because in ancient times, I guess it might have meant some kind of taboos when it comes to marriage, weddings. Nowadays, of course, we are in different times, so we kind of lost it. And by losing the language, we actually lose a lot of our cultural autonomy, spirituality. We lose a lot about intellectual sovereignty. We lose a lot of our soul, metaphorically speaking, and by reconnecting with language. Of course, we are not going to revive all the cultural traits that used to be, but it gives some kind of pride. I think that every nationalist movement, or every national movement, for example, in the case of Zionism, strives for ancientness. You wanted, if you were Eliezer Ben Yehuda, you know, the father of Israeli or of the Hebrew revival, you wanted to be as ancient as possible. Eliezer Ben Yehuda's dream was to speak like a biblical Jew. And therefore he envied the Arabs with a ha, with a ta, with a aw, with a ta. My name Gilad was like that pronounced in Hebrew. Nowadays everybody pronounces it Gilad. A little bit like Julia Gilad, you know, Gilad. And some Aussies write it with an R, Gilad, you know, as in Gilad. Look, this was his dream. But of course, you cannot ignore your most recent heritage. In the case of Jews coming to Israel after the Holocaust or before the Holocaust in the Fendersiekel, it was Yiddish. Even though Eliezer Ben Yehuda hated Yiddish, his mameloshen, his mother tongue, he could not avoid its shackles. So this kind of cultural renewal has its limits, and we should not lament it. We should embrace the new hybridic language, which we should not chastise the new speakers. We should never say, give us authenticity or give us death. Because if we say that, as some elders in the Tiwi Island, you know, near Darwin said, if you say that to the young people, give us authenticity or give us death, you will end up with death. You will end up with the young people resorting to the colonizer's language, namely English or Australian or Strian, rather than speaking kind of a different or a hybridic form of Tiwi. I have a friend, Timothy Karetu, in Aotearoa. Timothy is a prescriptivist, a purist, and he doesn't like it when you make mistakes in Te Reo Māori, the language Māori. But of course, it's counterproductive because some people would see him and walk to the other side of the pavement, not wanting to talk to him because they are afraid. It can be counterproductive. So I would embrace, champion hybridity.
But do you think there's a danger in this idea of revitalization altogether that you could devalue current ways that the Jewish people or Aboriginal people in Australia or Maori people actually speak now?
Absolutely. So David Ben-Gurion, who was the first prime minister of Israel in 1948, but also he was the leader of the Yishuv before the establishment of Israel. He listened to Rozhka Korchak. She was a Holocaust survivor. This is the beginning of 1945, the end of 1944. She spoke in the Histadrut, which is an organization in Israel, which used to be very important. And she spoke in Yiddish, her mamelotion, her mother tongue. And David Ben-Gurion, I cannot forget it. I mean, of course, I was not there. I was born in 1971. But I cannot forget how horrible it was when I read about it first time. He said, "Zeata dibra po chavera besafa zara vetzoremet." We have just heard a comrade speaking in a language that is foreign and cacophonous, referring to the Jewish language called Yiddish, which is Judeo-German. This is shocking in today's terms. It's the irony of history. Zionism tried to kill Yiddish because Yiddish represented the diasporic, persecuted, and of course Zionism is based on two negations. One is the negation of the diaspora and the other is the negation of religion. And you can see the residues of this in today's Israel. It's fascinating and multifaceted. But the irony of history, Zionism wanted to cancel Yiddish, but Yiddish survives beneath Israeli. So this self-loathing definitely played a part, but it did not succeed. And of course, these days, which is what, 75 years after the establishment of Israel, if we talk about Israeli now, I think it's time to say, okay, we self-loathed Yiddish, but actually Yiddish is a fascinating language. So I think that if we get rid of this imprisoning purism prism, if you allow me an alliteration, and if we kind of get into a more realistic Weltanschauung, you know, world view, then we end up empowering people who have lost everything in their lives.
And what is the ultimate aim? I mean, you mentioned getting kids to acquire the language so that they become native speakers, but is there also an institutional element of expanding the domains in which the language is used? Because if kids were just speaking at home, like in the family, that is a relatively limited domain. Like if you look at the example of Israel again, modern Hebrew or Israeli is a language that is used in all domains of life, so in education, the government, business, and so on.
It's a wonderful point, and the answer is what do the custodians want? The custodians are their language owners. We are facilitators. We are revivalists, but the custodians are at the wheel. They can decide to go the full Monty, meaning to have their grandchildren native speakers of the Neo-Bangla or the Neo-Bayungu or the Neo language. They can also decide, we don't care about native speech, we want a post-vernacular phase, just like Yiddish in America. Most Jews in America would know the word schlep, like to take one thing from one place to another or to take yourself from. Jews in America would know this, but they would not know how to speak Yiddish. I'm not talking about the ultra-Orthodox of New York, as of course they do speak Yiddish natively, but I'm talking about the secular Jews. It's post-vernacular, as my friend Jeffrey Chandler coined, post-vernacular. Or te reo Maori in New Zealand is post-vernacular. Every Maori knows whakapapa, heritage. Every Maori knows iwi, which is a canoe or a tribe. Every Maori knows whanau. Whanau is like the family or the chamula. Every Maori would know te taurawhiri, the Maori Language Commission, which is like a bundled rope, you know. But how many Maori, what is the percentage of Maori kids speaking Maori or speaking Maori natively? Very low percentage. It's a severely endangered language. So coming back to the Aboriginal custodians, they can say, look, we want to know 100 words. We don't need more than that. They can also say, you know what we want? We want our language to be the official language of the region. Currently in New Zealand, you have two official languages, Te Reo Māori, the language Māori, and, surprise, the New Zealand Sign Language. English is not de jure, it's de facto. Australia has no official languages. Singapore has four, you know, Mandarin, English, Malay, and Tamil. Australia has zero. I would argue that Australia must have 401 approximately official languages, one Australian sign language, and 400 Aboriginal languages. Of course, English is de facto, but it doesn't need to be de jure. So, Bangla should be the official language of Galinyala. Now, what is Galinyala? Port Lincoln. How many people know that Galinyala is Port Lincoln? Well, more and more so, because now we've managed to convince the council, etc., to put signs. And there is a sign, Galinyala. And now more and more people know that Galinyala means Port Lincoln. But until recently, nobody knew, except us, you know, like, including Aboriginal people, they didn't know. And Gudnada is Port Augusta. So we also need not only to officialize the language, but also to change the landscape, the linguistic landscape. Don't forget that in Aboriginal spirituality, there is a trinity, not il Padre, il Figlio e lo Spirito Santo, not that trinity, but the land, the language, and the people. The land, it does not belong to the people. Rather, the people belong to the land. The language belongs to the land. So if you speak to a kangaroo in Galinyala, Port Lincoln, you need to speak Bangla. You cannot speak Ghana. The kangaroo, according to that spirituality, would not understand you. It would understand Bangla because both belong to the land.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for answering those questions.
Oh, it's a pleasure, James. It's always wonderful to talk to you, and keep up the good work.
Yeah, and thanks for coming all the way to Hamburg.
It's a pleasure. Meine Großmutter ist in Hamburg geboren. My grandmother was born in Hamburg, and it's actually the first time in which I see this beautiful city. Bye.